that's a growler.
Welcome back to Beauty and the Beastly Minute, the podcast where we break down and analyze Beauty and the Beast, 1 minute at a time. I'm Bobby from Growler Media.
And I'm Carrie from the LDS Dating Podcast.
And today, we have with us a special guest, Bradley Pierce, who is the voice behind Chip. You might also recognize him because he played Peter in Jumanji and Pete from The Borrowers.
Hey everybody, how you doing?
Hey, we're glad we finally got you on here.
Yeah, it's been a minute trying to get it to work together, but looks like it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, we're excited, and this is one of my favorite minutes of the movie, just because it's part of the mob song, and we talked about it last minute, but I really love the mob song, even though it's like, the meaning behind it isn't that great, because they're going to kill the beast, but it's such a good song.
And villain songs are always a lot of fun.
Yes.
They've got that intensity and that flair to them, this one especially, because it's got the ensemble singing behind it. All the villagers. It's a really good minute.
It is. And this is minute 70, in case you didn't look at the title of the episode. And today, our minute starts with the village mob marching through the town, singing, "We won't rest till he's good and deceased," and ends with Cogsworth saying, "If it's a fight they want, we'll be ready for them. Who's with me?" Ah! Because he's alone again. Seems like that's happened. I guess this is the second time. We covered the Human Again song. So we did kind of the re-release version, and we have Human Again in here. And they did kind of the same thing before the Human Again song. So this is the second time we've seen everybody leave him alone as he tries to do a rallying call.
It's one of those things where no one ever actually listens to Cogsworth. It's funny, Lumiere is not the one who's supposed to be able to rally everybody, but everybody seems to follow him.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, they usually do actually do what Cogsworth says. He tells them to do something and they go do it, but he doesn't expect them to do it as quickly, I guess. And so he just kind of gets left there on his own.
Yeah.
But to start off, I guess probably everybody wants to know, how did you land the part of playing Chip in this movie?
Okay. I had started acting when I was about 6 years old, and I had done a few voiceovers and a couple of commercials, something on TV, before I got the opportunity for Beauty and the Beast. I actually entered the union, the Screen Actors Guild, as a result of some voiceover work I did for a Hallmark Channel animated cartoon. And I auditioned for Beauty and the Beast like I would audition for anything else. It was just another day in a studio. Went in and recorded the 3 or 4 lines they had written. There was actually only one line for Chip, but they wanted a little bit more voice testing in the audition.
Right.
So I did the whatever 4 lines they had written, and it was almost 6 months before I got the call back that they wanted to see me again, and that was just the one line of Chip, which was, "Mama, there's a girl in the castle." That was the very first Chip line. And then about 2-3 months later, they called me in again, and now there was 3 or 4 more lines they wanted to record. And then they kept adding more and more and more. So it actually took a process of about 2 years to record everything that Chip said.
Wow.
From what I've read, you know, it did start out with that one line. Was there something that, like, you did, or is there a story behind, like, them adding more lines to it? Or did they just call you back kind of out of the blue and say, "Hey, we have some more lines we want you to do"?
From my end, the call was just kind of out of the blue. They just wanted to do another session, and they had added a couple more lines. Conversations I've had with Don Hahn, the producer, and some of the other people involved, they were saying that the creative team, the writers and director, producer, all thought that there needed to be a childlike character, someone that the children could relate to when they watched the movie, because that really didn't exist. So there was a character that was going to be sort of communicating the same kind of energy, I guess, as Chip did. It was a music box that would just be chiming throughout some of the scenes, but they kept replacing music box with a teacup, and I kept getting more work.
Well, that works out, I guess.
Yeah, it worked out great for me, and I think it really, I don't know how it would have worked without Chip the teacup, but I think he ended up, you know, becoming a really relatable character, and a lot of people really related to Chip and him trying to understand and fit in, and that became one of their favorite characters.
He's definitely one of my favorites. Cogsworth and Chip are my absolute favorites of the movie. Even probably more than Belle and Beast, which is weird.
Uh-oh.
I know.
Scandal.
Yeah. I think you're definitely right. Like, we've gone through, as we've done the other episodes, and some of them we've read the earlier versions of the screenplays. And so we've read a little bit about the music box and some of his parts. And I think the changes that they did make to give Chip more of a role in here definitely helped the film move along. I mean, obviously, we'll never know how I would have felt about growing up with Music Box instead of Chip, but I like the changes looking back that they did do. And he really becomes a big part of the story. He's not just like a secondary character. I mean, he's obviously not the main character, but Chip has a big role in this movie, and he kind of saves the day here in a little bit.
Yeah, I was going to say, in a couple more minutes, we're going to watch me save Belle, which ends up resulting in being able to save Beast.
Yeah.
Everyone.
Yeah, I save them all.
Go Chip.
Although I couldn't have done it without Maurice's crazy invention.
Yeah, that invention. We can jump into the minute a little bit here, because that's what we're supposed to be talking about.
All right.
I did have a note on here about when they're kind of stuck in the room, they're going back and forth. Why can't they just open that window? I mean, Belle's there trying to pry the window open with a stick or something, but they're in his workshop. The cellar is Maurice's workshop. Why can't he find something in there to like break the window or break the cellar door or find some way to get out?
That's a good question. I'm sure that there's a right-handed thingamawrenchet or a hammer or something down there they could have used.
Yeah.
Possibly panic. Maybe they just weren't in the right mindset.
Well, if you look at the window, it does have crossbars. So Chip would probably fit through the glass squares, but Belle and Maurice couldn't actually fit through the glass, so breaking it wouldn't help much.
Well, I figured they just like take the whole window frame out. It's just wood.
Oh. Oh yeah, you and your handyman brain. It's not just breaking glass options.
But it works out because this gives Chip an opportunity to have his epiphany moment and come up with this idea to break them out in a few minutes. So
yeah,
it's good.
And it also lets the machine serve a purpose because
it
never did make it to the fair.
Yeah, I was always a little sad. We never got to know if he would actually have won or not. But he ends up being, I guess, like semi-royalty. So it all works out.
Yes. During the mob sequence, I know that they used a lot of multi-cell layering during the animation process. And there's a couple of parts of this minute where you can see a lot of that. When they're going across the river, I think there's like 4 or 5 layers to that shot.
Yeah. I remember reading when we first started out at the movie, and especially in like that very first opening sequence when we're kind of zooming into the castle through the forest, I found a lot of interesting stuff about how they layered it to give it a lot more depth. You can really see that in some of these shots. Even though it's not three-dimensional, it gives you a feel of depth the way that they did it.
Part of this minute was Chip's reaction when he sees the axe gleaming on the front of the machine on the hill. Uh-huh. I remember that was an interesting thing to record because voice acting is always about, or not always, but a lot of times is about subtlety. And an interesting thing about trying to record a gasp reaction, especially from a child, is trying to make sure it is audible without sounding too forced. And we managed to get it, but then somebody in the room, and I'm not sure exactly what it was, but they realized that there's no way that just the gas was going to play over a mob of singing people. So we had to go in again and go from a literal to a ah, and it completely changed the reaction and, you know, the emotion behind that delivery. And it's such a little piece, but in order to get it to work, we had to probably go through 12 or 15 different versions of a gasp.
Wow. So how did they coach you on something like that? I mean, did they just say gasp, or, you know, does the person directing you at that point, do they kind of act out what they want you to do and then you do it? Or how does the coaching for that work?
Well, with almost all of Chip's lines and sounds, I would do 3 versions. So it would be, you know, Mama, there's a girl in the castle. Mama, there's a girl in the castle. Mama, there's a girl in the castle. They would all be a little bit different. And then I would, you know, either the vocal director in the room or one of the people who was in the booth would say, okay, we really liked the second one you did, but try and go a little faster or a little slower. And they would sort of try to dial it in through, you know, becoming less different each time until they got a version they liked. And usually that could be 2 to 3 takes. On some of the lines, they would read me their version of the performance, and then I would parrot it and do as close as I could to that.
Right.
With things like the gasp, this was a long time ago, but if I remember correctly, the beginning of it, you know, gave them 3 different type of sounds, and then they would narrow it down and have me go into a different, you know, let's go a little bit bigger or a little bit longer, a little louder, until we got one that we liked. There was actually really one of the funnier stories that I like to tell about recording was when I was recording the sequence where Maurice first meets Chip and Mrs. Potts. The line was, "His mustache tickles mama." And I had read the line just on the page and I was going to do my three deliveries. And one of them that I did was, "His mustache tickles mama." Not knowing, you know, what emphasis I was putting on it or how I had turned the writing into a piece of adult humor. Everyone in the booth starts laughing, and I can see it, I can't hear it, but they're just laughing hysterically, and I didn't understand why. So I said, "What's so funny? What's everybody laughing at?" And somebody said, "We'll tell you when you're older." And that ended up becoming the line in the sequence after something there that wasn't there before. They built that, "What? What's there? We'll tell you when you're older, Chip." It just,
wow.
It all grew out of a not necessarily botched, but a poor delivery choice on my part.
That is awesome. Yeah, I was going to say, I know from reading some stuff about like Paige O'Hara that a lot of her physical traits and little things that she did kind of made their way into Belle's character as we see her in the film. So I was going to ask, like, were there any things that you noticed that they kind of translated into Chip from you? But I guess like that whole sequence there kind of came from something you did.
There was actually a lot of things that became part of Chip's design that matched my physical appearance. The gap in Chip's teeth was something that I had when I was younger. I had some fairly prominent front teeth, and there was a bit of a gap between the two of them. And the sequence when he gets thrown into the tub and comes up and spits the water, that was something that I had gone to visit my uncle in Arizona, and he had a hot tub, and he taught me how to spit water between my teeth and spray it across the hot tub. And I learned how to do that. And, you know, I was probably 7 years old at the time. So I thought that was one of the coolest things ever. And I just needed to show everybody. So we were at the studio and I was showing one of the vocal directors that trick that I had learned. And that ended up being animated into the character. And I think may have been part of the "want to see me do a trick" when Chip blows bubbles. Because that whole interaction was about me doing things I probably shouldn't have been doing, and I'm sure my mom probably corrected me. "Now, Bradley, stop it."
Yeah. That's awesome. It's like the kind of good stuff you don't get from just searching the internet.
Yeah.
So did you get to meet a lot of people when you were working on the film? Obviously, you were really young, and I'm pretty sure they didn't have like all the different characters like Angela Lansbury and David Ogden Stiers and Paige O'Hara. You know, I don't think y'all all recorded together, did you?
No, we all recorded separately, with the exception of some of the songs. And I know that Paige and Robbie recorded a lot of their stuff together, occasionally with Richard White. But, I recorded almost all of mine separately. Now I did see Paige a couple of times and Angela Lansbury. Either they would be coming out of their session as I was going in, or, vice versa, because they would have, you know, 5 recording sessions scheduled in a day.
Mm-hmm.
So we would see each other in passing, but we didn't really get a chance to work together, unfortunately.
Right.
Since then, I've gotten to know them. I mean, since I've become an adult and there's been a lot of Beauty and the Beast related events and stuff like that, I've gotten to know some of them personally outside of the actual work, which has been great. Mm-hmm. But during the process, you know, I didn't really get to know them very well.
Right. And I would imagine that you weren't actually like working on the film for a large amount of time, since you just go in a few times and record your parts.
Some of the sessions were as quick as 45 minutes. Others were, you know, 4 to 6 hours. And it really varied depending on how much had been written and how much had been rewritten, what we were going back to cover again.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what I was doing near the end of the recording sessions was actually recording stuff that I had done at the very beginning, because even though my voice hadn't changed a lot, it had changed enough between 6 and 8 that they wanted to re-record some of those early lines to match my delivery as an 8-year-old.
I didn't even think about that. When you're working on a movie for 2 years, you got to think about things like that.
Yeah. And I mean, it would have been even more difficult, obviously, if I had been going, you know, into my teen years or something. But just from 6 to 8, there is enough of a change. I don't think it was as much in the pitch of my voice as in the clarity of it and the way that I would say things. My enunciation was different.
Right.
But yeah, a lot of the stuff near the end was just re-recording.
That kind of brings us to a question that we've had throughout the movie is the whole aging theory, whether or not the characters are aging through this 10-year long curse. Do you have any theories about that? Was Chip aging this whole time, or was he always this 8-year-old boy?
My theory is that time was frozen by the spell. So even though days went by, none of the characters necessarily got older. I think that that helps solve some of the problem people have with the prince, who was cursed to be the beast, would have been probably 12 years old when he was cursed. And that's, you know, a lot of people say a 12-year-old boy doesn't answer the door for an old woman. That's not a bad thing. But if he was in his 20s when he shunned her, it makes it a bit more of a, you know, personality defect on his part.
Yeah.
And so if everybody froze in time, it would keep anybody from, you know, aging or being injured during the curse.
I like it.
That's my theory on it. It's definitely not something that's super clear, but it's the theory I go with.
Yeah, so they didn't give you any secret background information on the story that they didn't tell other people?
No, unfortunately they didn't. The clarity that it was in the original animated is exactly the same for everybody. There may have been things that were explained in story meetings, but not necessarily to us.
Right, right.
And this is not something that I think you guys do a lot of in your minutes, but there were a lot of, not necessarily plot holes, but things that people had questions about that I think got answered really well with the new live action that they did. For example, when Belle has to get Beast onto the back of Philippe to take him back to the castle after the wolf attack, everybody was wondering how the 120 maybe-ish pound girl lifted the 245 pound Beast onto the back of her horse. But in the movie, in the live action, they're like, I need you to stand. I need you to help me. And he does. Like, closing up little things like that made it, answered a lot of questions for people. And I think helped put some bows on some of those questions that people had.
Yeah, they definitely tried to answer a lot of the plot holes that were left from the original one. And I don't personally agree with some of the methods that they used for that. But some of them do work. And a lot of the stuff that I thought about as we were preparing and doing the podcast before the 2017 version came out, like, I went and saw it. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that's kind of the same thing that I had reasoned out.
Yeah, I think they went in a lot of cases with the most logical possible answer. I don't know if that's always the best thing when you're dealing with enchanted objects, but hey, it works.
And then what are your thoughts on the 2017 version?
And Chip.
I thought it was really visually really well done. I thought they did a great job of trying to balance the cartooniness and the fun of some of it with the reality. And I feel the one thing that was a little bit difficult was because all of the objects were brought into a realistic realm, they lost a lot of the softness that they had.
Right.
And that was something especially noticeable with Mrs. Potts and Chip. Cogsworth and Lumiere to be a little more metallic and rigid. It suits their characters. It suits their purpose. But Mrs. Potts and Chip are both supposed to be soft, warm, literally, objects. And I think to have them as these hard, gold inlaid objects made them feel a little bit too cold. They didn't feel friendly. And I feel like that was the one weak point within the visualization. But I liked the story. I liked the way they closed the potholes for the most part. I liked the visuals. I liked the music. The added song, I think, was a good one. There was other options they could have brought in as well from the Broadway version that could have worked really well. But all in all, I think it was a really well put together movie and I enjoyed it.
Awesome, awesome.
Did your kids miss hearing your voice in the new one?
I don't know, to be honest with you. They liked the new one, but both of my older ones said that they preferred the original. So that's a compliment, I think, to what we were able to do and, you know, the magic that we were able to grab with the chemistry of the cast and the talent of all of the amazing animators involved. Because it was something that, you know, you just don't see anymore. The way movies are done, especially animated movies, almost all of them are CG and digital animation now. The actual, you know, pen and paint animation is not something that we see enough of anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that that's part of why kids, including mine, preferred the original.
I was wondering, do you own all of the movies that you've been in? I've always wondered if actors and voice actors, you know, did you go out and buy Jumanji and Beauty and the Beast and keep them on a special shelf for kind of your portfolio?
I do own most of the movies that I was a part of. I think there's probably a couple I don't have, but for most actors, at least, we keep a demo reel. We keep our material that we've recorded, whether it's on TV or voice or whatever, in some sort of, you know, digital format. I actually got a VHS sitting on my shelf right now from when I was probably 13 years old that has little clips from all of the movies I had done in the past, you know, in the 3 years leading up to that, edited That's together. Fun. And that was something that I would use. I would send that to prospective producers and things like that to hopefully get hired. So most actors do have most of their stuff somewhere. Now, usually it's not, you know, prominently displayed on like a shelf of pride or what have you. the trophy case mentality, there are some people that do that, but it's not generally, I don't know many people who do. I knew one actor who had posters from all of his projects that he had been in and, you know, signed by his fellow actors, but he had all of them, you know, in little frames and cases that he could flip through, almost like you would have at a store when you were going to buy the photos and pictures. Right. And he had those in one space in his living room. And that was, you know, because people would ask and people would want to see that, but it's not necessarily something you want to look at on a regular basis yourself. You know, it is something to be proud of, but it just, there can be so much of it that it becomes overwhelming.
I always imagined actors would have like something akin to Shark Week and say, okay, family, we're going to sit down and watch all my movies and TV shows.
That's funny. I have never done a marathon of all of my movies. In fact, there's a point where it's like, everybody's, oh, hey, let's watch Beauty and the Beast again. I've seen it. And, you know, it can be fun, but it's also one of those, like, how many times can you watch any movie without, you know, and still find that enjoyment in it?
Right.
And
for kids, it's like 5,000 times.
Yes, this is true. And we were watching Beauty and the Beast on repeat at one point at my house. And then Cars came out and I was fine. We switched over. It's always fun. And I like now, I would say I probably watch a movie that I was in maybe once a year. And it's always, you know, for a reason. Like I did a live stream of Jumanji a couple of years ago. And then Beauty and the Beast, I watched again recently. And then there was the screening before that. So, you know, I've got no problem with watching my own work, but it's also, it's a difficult thing because it's, you're proud of it, but you don't want to be too proud of it because then it kind of seems arrogant. So like you have to try to find that balance.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely something that I love talking about. I love answering questions about, and it's not necessarily something that I will watch on a regular basis.
Right. Now you were so young whenever you worked on Beauty and the Beast, and even like when they were putting it together, nobody really knew that it was going to have as much success as it did at that time. Like, did you have any idea like how big it was going to be and like what you were working on?
Well, again, it's a Disney movie. Disney movies are not ignored.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people say that they are surprised that Beauty and the Beast did as well as it did. But really, if you think about what Disney was doing, all of their movies around that time were doing very well. They're all still classics. Everybody remembers Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Lion King. That part of Disney animation is one of the most memorable and successful periods in Disney animation. Nobody knew it was going to be successful, but I also don't think there's many people who were surprised that it was.
Right.
That's like saying that, you know, you're working on, I'm trying to think if there's an equivalent out there, but, you know, because there really isn't. It's, you know, Disney is in a class by itself and has been for years.
Yeah.
But did I know that it would be nominated for an Oscar? No, I definitely didn't expect that.
Mm-hmm.
But was I fully aware as a child of the fact that I was working on a Disney movie like all of the ones I have on my shelf? Yeah, I knew that and I was excited about it. I thought it was going to be awesome and it was. I really don't think that it was as surprising for any of the people working on it as some people seemed to have thought it was. We knew fairly early on that we had something that had the potential to be magical and really make a huge difference for some people. But, you know, the exact level of that and how people would be affected by it, I don't think we knew that, no.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's really impressed me as we've gone through the movie and looked at the people that worked on it, especially the animators. I'm sure you saw we had Tony Bancroft on a while back. And when he worked on Beauty and the Beast, you know, he was just like barely starting out his animation career and, you know, went on to direct Disney films and now has moved on to other things. But it seems like the more I look into the history of the people that worked on the film, I see that happening over and over again, that everyone that worked on it had so much talent and has gone on to do so many amazing things. Even kind of the smaller people, the ones that did the not as important jobs, you would think have gone on to do these amazing things and have had these amazing careers. And I look at it and I see how much talent there was in this one spot making this film. And it makes me appreciate so much more the work that went into it. And, you know, it's a film that I've loved for a long time and grown up with. And it's great to be able to get to know the people that made it happen, because I think we overlook them a lot and just say, hey, it's Beauty and the Beast. And, you know, sometimes get the main actors, but don't always recognize the hundreds of people that went into making this something that's memorable.
Yeah, that's definitely a very strong point. There's a lot of people involved in any film, you know, whether it's somebody who is doing cleanup on somebody else's animation or somebody who, as silly as it might sound, is the one who runs the new copy to make sure that everybody has the most current version of the script.
Mm-hmm.
There is so much energy and talent and drive required at every level. And that's one thing that, especially at Disney, but any of the really successful companies manages to do, is they make sure that everybody realizes how important their piece is. Yes, you are part of a much larger machine, but that machine doesn't function without every single part.
Right.
It's really a very strong... It's very important for everybody to realize that right now you may just be erasing the pencil marks on somebody else's animation, but if you're good enough at that, they'll let you pick up a pencil soon, you know? And like, that's the evolution of it. And some of the people that I worked with that were lead animators then have gone on, like you said, to do directing and producing and other things. Other people that were, you know, cleanup artists are now animators, and in some cases even directors and producers in their own right.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things where the limitations of drive and creativity are the only things that stop these people.
Right. And then what kind of an impact did being part of this movie have on you, I guess, afterwards? And it's kind of weird to think of how young you were when you worked on this, that, you know, the after it was still, you know, you were what, like 9, 10, and all of your teenage years and going forward, how did this impact you?
Yeah, I think being a part of this as a child is even more magical than being a part of it as an adult, because you really get to feel like you're a part of something bigger. And that was really, really interesting. The success aspect of it was something that I realized, I'm trying to figure out how to say this correctly. There's a lot of rejection and a lot of hearing no in the acting industry. And mm-hmm. to have a success like Beauty and the Beast to balance that against was really something that helped me keep my motivation, not only as an actor, but just as a person, realizing that sometimes lots and lots of doors will close. But that's okay, because the one door that you're supposed to open, you haven't gotten to yet. So the lesson that I came away with from Beauty and the Beast, and also later from Jumanji and other films, was that I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be, and I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing, regardless of how many times it feels like I'm being shut out or told no.
Mm-hmm.
That growth process and, you know, the progression of, people say, failing forward, or, you know, falling so that you can learn to pick yourself up, whatever that thought process is, everybody goes through it in one way or another. I got to learn it in a very early and very real way because of the acting industry and because of projects like Beauty and the Beast.
Wow, that was inspiring. I want to put my kids in acting now.
Well, I've had conversations with a lot of parents. If your kids love this industry, if they want to do this, then there's a possibility of success. If they're doing it because you tell them to, they might get a few successes, a few jobs here and there. But if it's just a push from you, they won't have the passion for it. They won't have the ability to hear no 99 times before mm-hmm. they hear that one yes. I am a proponent of the acting industry and, you know, of getting kids into it if they want to. But they have to want it. I know kids, I have my two older boys, I have a 12-year-old and a 9-year-old, they both wanted to be actors. This was years ago, and it was actually after watching Jumanji, my eldest asked if he could be on TV too. I said, sure, we can give that a try. And he still wants to act, and he still goes on auditions occasionally, and he still books a job here and there. My younger son said he wanted to as well, and he did for a couple of years. And then he decided he didn't want to anymore, and so he doesn't. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it was an experience that I was able to offer them because I had been there and they gave it a shot and they enjoyed it. And one likes it and the other one doesn't. So I've allowed them to, you know, pursue what they want. It's an amazing opportunity. And it's one of those things where the skills that you learn, the interactions with other people are so powerful, and it's such a great tool to give a child. Mm-hmm. But it's no stronger than, you know, being on a baseball team or taking gymnastics. I mean, whatever it is that a kid is interested in, if you can support them in that and really find a passion for them, then that's the best thing you can do as a parent, I think.
Chip gives good parenting advice.
There you go.
I love it. I mean, our kids are never going to see us on a movie. So how would you bring that up without feeling like you're pushing it on them? You just say like, hey, this is a job people do, and see if they say, hey, I'd like to do it.
That's one way. The way that I became an actor, mm-hmm. it was a really interesting genesis of things. I was actually in Arizona. I was born and raised there until I was about 6 years old. And my grandmother owned a restaurant near a lake up where a lot of filmmakers would come out and use it as a location. And I would help out there as much as I could because my mom was the general manager. My grandmother was the owner. Both of my uncles were chefs. So it was the place where the family was. It was the family business. So I would hang out a lot. And I would always help with things because you can't have a 6-year-old boy in a restaurant and not have him doing things, cause all kinds of damage. So I would, you know, take bread to tables and things like that. And at one point I got into a conversation with a group of producers from Fox. And I don't remember what we talked about, but apparently we talked for 20 minutes. And afterwards, wow. they called my mom over and they said, you know, he's really precocious. He's got a great attitude. He'd probably do really well in the acting business. Have you ever thought about putting him into it? Her response was something to the effect of, yeah, he asked me a couple days ago if he could be on TV. I was watching something and I wanted to be on TV like those kids. And so I said, okay, here's the names of some agents and here's how you can get some headshots done. And they gave her the basic information. Mm-hmm. And a few months later, we took a trip out to California to, you know, meet with some agents on the first day. We were going to go to Disneyland on the second day and then do some sightseeing and drive home on the third. One of the agents we met with said if we stayed here, she could pretty much guarantee that I would work. If we stayed for 2 months and didn't book anything, she would pay the living expenses for those 2 months. If we did, we signed a 1-year contract with her. So the next day, instead of going to Disneyland, we found an apartment and we decided to give it a shot. And a few weeks later, I booked my first commercial. A few weeks after that, I booked another commercial and then another one. And I haven't gone back since. Mm-hmm. It's been, you know, a great road. But basically, it worked out where I was watching TV and I said I wanted to be on TV. And it happened that door opened, you know, a few weeks later. It's wow. It's not a story that happens often, but I think that you know, the easiest way, if you want to try to get your kids into acting professionally, start with acting for fun. You know, there's school plays, there's shows, depending on where you are in the country, there's probably children's theater groups. Get involved in one of those productions, and if they love it, then they can move on to the next thing, you know, and try to pursue this as a career. I've told a lot of parents, if this is something you want to do professionally, or if your children want to do professionally, I've told everybody who would listen, if you want to act professionally, you have to do it in LA. If you're going to come to LA to try to pursue acting, make sure you have at least 6 months of all of your expenses here saved up. Because if you come out here, even if you're one of the lucky ones and manage to book a job within your first 3 months, you don't get your first paycheck until almost 8 weeks after that. Mm. You know, so just to get started is at least 6 months. And a lot of people, they take the leap to come out here, but they don't leap far enough. They don't invest in the time it will take to actually get somewhere here. And they end up going home broke and uninspired, unfortunately.
Mm, that's sad.
It is. It is very sad.
Now, going kind of forward from the movie, if I remember right, most of the stuff that you've been doing since like Jumanji and Borrowers has kind of been behind the scenes stuff, whether that be through voiceover work. I think you've done a lot of that stuff. And then you're also doing some kind of more producing now. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. I have done some on-camera stuff recently, but most of that has been either student film or things that I'm producing myself. And part of that is that the industry has changed a lot with the creation of so many new platforms out there like YouTube and YouTube Red, Netflix, Amazon. Mm-hmm. And they're not getting their content through the same ways that they always have. The industry is changing and I'm trying to change with it as best I can. Mm-hmm. When I was about 16, I decided I wanted to take a break because I knew that I loved acting, but I wasn't sure if I loved it because it's what I had been doing basically my whole life at that point, or if it was something I really was passionate about. So I decided to try other things and, you know, expose myself to the regular, normal experiences of high school. And by the time I was about 20, I had decided that I definitely wanted to get back into the industry and I definitely wanted to be an actor. And I realized that during the 4 years I was gone, the industry had changed around me and trying to get back into it was more challenging than I expected. So I got together with friends of mine that were, you know, also passionate about creating really amazing entertainment and have been working with some of them since to try to, you know, get their projects off the ground and get some of my own stuff going and create something better, create new entertainment.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy to see the shift in things. And, you know, this is obviously getting kind of far away from the Beauty and the Beast minute, but just looking at what people are excited about these days. I mean, obviously the super big movies, people are talking about them, but I feel like people talk a lot more about the Netflix series that's coming out or the Amazon Prime series or, you know, whatever it is, these smaller kind of more independent things that have popped up here and there seem to have a lot more people interested in them than the big name production companies putting out, you know, their latest movie.
Yeah, that's true in a lot of ways. And I feel like what it is people still appreciate and get excited about these giant blockbuster films, but they can feel the magic and the passion and the honesty of some of the smaller than the boutique entertainment. Mm-hmm. And that's a really interesting thing. Something that popped back into my brain as a result of our conversation. During Beauty and the Beast, I actually ended up, this is how much the industry has changed. They needed me to record two more lines for something, a sequence they rewrote. I don't remember exactly, but I was on the East Coast visiting my grandmother in Delaware and they needed it done by the end of the week. So they bought me a train ticket to New York City. They put me up in a hotel room. They took me into a studio in New York because it was one of the only studios in the country that had a ISDN line at the time. It was one of the only places that was fast enough to have a two-way communication with a studio here in Disney in Los Angeles and in New York. So they had to go through all of the expense and time and planning and all of that to record those two lines in New York. The industry is so different now that they probably would have just had me record it at home and send it in. It's auditions are a completely different thing. The way these projects are created is completely different. I remember when I was younger, when I was growing up, like when I went to audition for Beauty and the Beast, I did that on the Disney lot. They gave me a drive-on pass. I parked on the lot. I walked in. I recorded it in a studio with their engineer and one of their voice directors. Now, auditions come across in an email, say, here's the copy, send us an MP3 with, you know, these settings, and make sure you put your name on the file so we don't misplace it. Like, that's 99% of all of the voiceover auditions now.
Well, no wonder it's not as magical anymore.
Yeah, it's a completely different game now. And in some ways, that's great, because it really allows the right voices to shine. The only problem with it is a lot of times the voice directors are getting people that don't necessarily know how to follow direction because they're only getting that one clip that got sent over rather than working in the room with somebody.
Right.
But yeah, it's a huge change and technology is going so quickly, but it's definitely a new world.
Is it a whole new world?
Oh, there it is. There's something there that wasn't there before.
Oh good. We haven't had enough puns in this episode. Awesome. I have some smaller notes, but I mean we're kind of running out of time here on the episode. Did you have anything else that you wanted to share with us about your experience working on the film, or, you know, this minute, or I don't know, your favorite part of Beauty and the Beast?
Well, as far as my favorite part of the movie Beauty and the Beast, I really I still really have a soft spot for Be Our Guest. I think it's a beautifully done song. The animation's great. The music is spectacular. Greatest memories of the project. I already told you about a few of them. And I feel like those are the things that I remember most. And this particular minute that we were talking about, I don't really have, it's a really interesting question about why they couldn't get themselves out of the basement. I don't know the answer to that. It's definitely an interesting glitch, plot hole,
yeah.
Mistake. I don't know. There should have been a way out of that basement that didn't involve crashing the machine to the cellar door, but I don't know.
I think we have to chalk that one up to your charm that you had, and I guess they just wanted you to have a little extra part in there.
Yes, they just needed to make sure that Chip did something amazing.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to say, it's not in this minute, but I think it's like 2 minutes from now, my favorite Chip line, when he crashes through and he's hanging from that little dangly coil or whatever. You guys gotta try this.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. We recorded all of the voice for that scene all at once, all within one day. So it was the, here we go, and you guys gotta try this thing. And it was the way they captured it, it really is a lot of fun, because it's that like playfulness of a child that just crashed his bike.
Yeah.
You know? It was fun.
Very child-esque. I think they did a really good job with pretty much all the children, especially Chip and the kids in the village, that they have very childlike mannerisms. And like when Maurice says, oh, I never thought I'd see you again, little fella. And Chip turns right to Belle. He doesn't even respond to Maurice. Very childlike.
Why'd you go away?
Oh, that was so sad.
Yeah, well, I feel like Chip might have had a little bit of a crush on Belle himself.
Oh, that's a good theory. Never thought of that.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
But... Well, why else is he going to hop in her bag and...
Yeah, it totally makes sense.
Whoa, mind blown.
There it is.
So was that a little Bradley crush on Paige that came through in the movie?
I didn't even know Paige.
But you saw her.
I did. I'm going to say no to that, actually. She seemed really nice, but no, I did not have a crush on her.
Okay, so just Chip.
Sorry.
Well, there was a much bigger age difference, too.
Yeah, I guess there was.
Yeah.
I don't remember how old she was at the time.
Yeah, I don't remember her exact age, but I watched an interview that she did, and she was talking about how Belle looked like her, but like a much younger version of herself. And Belle was 17, so if Chip was 8, that's already 10 years. So anything more than that, and I mean, that's a pretty big gap.
Yeah.
All right, well, that about wraps up our minute for today. We really appreciate you being here with us. And if people want to get a hold of you or check out any projects that you're doing, where can they go to do that, and what's the best way to connect with you?
Oh, yeah. I am on almost all of the social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and it's the same ID. It is at Mr. Bradley Pierce. That's Mr. Bradley, Bradley Pierce, Pierce. And there's also my website, which is MrBradleyPierce.com. And that's about it. Those are all great ways to keep track of me and figure out what I'm up to lately. And I post stuff on new projects to those regularly. And any questions or anything like that, I'm always happy to answer. So yeah, those are great ways to get in touch with me if anybody's interested.
Excellent.
Oh, thank you. And if you guys want to get a hold of us, as always, you can find us on the Growler Media website. Got all our old episodes there. Go check it out. Check out the other podcasts that Growler Media puts out. And you can find us on social media. Just search Beastly Minute. We'll pop up anywhere that you're looking for us, pretty much. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. We are on iTunes and anywhere podcasts are found. Hit that subscribe, rate and review, all that good stuff. Make sure to also go and check out Duo Hansen. They do our music intro and outro. And Megan the Cartoonist does our artwork. So you can find her on Facebook and Duo Hansen on YouTube. Thank you guys for being here with us. Be sure to come back again for minute 71. And until then, share this podcast with your friends. Just tell them, you guys gotta try this thing.
I like the tie-in. Well done.
Thank you. Thank you.
different.
I'm a growler.
If it's a fight they want, we'll be ready for them. Who's with me? Ah!
I'd save them all. We had to go in again and go from a literal to a ah. Mama, there's a girl in the castle. Mama, there's a girl in the castle. Mama, there's a girl in the castle. Whatever it is that a kid is interested in, if you can support them in that and really find a passion for them, then that's the best thing you can do as a parent, I think. But it's definitely a new world.
Is it a whole new world?
Oh, there it is. There's something there that wasn't there before.
Oh.
Here we go. You guys gotta try this thing. Why'd you go away?
I'm keeping your bones.